A judge tells alligator Alcatraz to shut down operations. Florida stages a major offensive against gay pride crosswalks. And should we deploy troops to defeat traffickers? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss why a federal judge last night gave the controversial migrant detention center known as Alligator Alcatraz 60 days to close down and allow no new detainees. We'll also ask why Florida and Governor Ron DeSantis seem obsessed with eradicating any public tribute to the LGBTQ community. And we'll examine President Trump's urge to send the U.S. military into Latin America to battle the region's drug cartels. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Late last night, a federal judge here in Miami ordered the dismantling of the controversial migrant detention center out in the Everglades known as Alligator Alcatraz. U.S. District Court Judge Kathleen Williams gave the Trump administration and the state of Florida 60 days to shut down Alligator Alcatraz's operations, and she barred them from bringing any additional detainees into the tent building structure. Williams ruled on environmental grounds. She agreed with the plaintiff's argument that because Alligator Alcatraz is a federally funded facility, it should have been subject to federal environmental standards before it was hastily constructed this summer. But it was not, she concluded, and she found the Trump administration's claim that the detention camp is a state and not federal facility, quote, unpersuasive. Her injunction comes on the heels of another federal ruling this week that left open the possibility that Alligator Alcatraz is violating detainees' constitutional access to attorneys. Joining me now to make sense of all this, we had hoped to have Elise Bennett, the Florida and Caribbean director of the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity, which was a plaintiff or is a plaintiff in the Alligator Alcatraz suit that was ruled on last night. But we have with us Hatzel Vela. He's the politics reporter for NBC6 here, who's been following this saga closely. Hatzel, for the moment, it's just you and me, and welcome and thanks very much for coming on.
Tim, thank you so much for having me.
We'd like to hear your thoughts about the Alligator Alcatraz dispute. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So Hatzel, the case Judge Williams has now ruled on seems to boil down to two key arguments. First, that Alligator Alcatraz is in fact a federal migrant detention center, if only because the feds are reimbursing Florida for its cost. And second, if it is a federal facility, its operation out in the eco-sensitive Everglades should have first met approval under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Briefly walk us through, Hatzel, from what you see, walk us through the case that the plaintiffs, which included, as I mentioned, the Center for Biological Diversity, the nonprofit Friends of the Everglades, and importantly, the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians, the case that they presented that led to last night's federal court injunction against Alligator Alcatraz.
So as you mentioned, there were two plaintiffs, right? So you had the Miccosukee Tribe of Florida. Their argument was basically that this was preventing them from using their land. As you know, this sits right next to Big Cypress, which is a preserve in reservation land. And so their concern was that they were not going to have access to that land. On the other, by the other side, you talked about that this did not go through the NEPA process. Can you hear me, Tim?
Yeah, we lost you just there for a second. Could you repeat what you just said?
Well, there was the major concern was it did not go through the right process, meaning there was no assessment done before any of the building happened, any of the facility building happened.
Hatzel, if I can just cut in there, and before we get to the NEPA factor, though, they first had to prove that Alligator Alcatraz is in fact a federal facility, which had to be subject to the NEPA. How did they eventually, essentially, prove to Judge Williams that Alligator Alcatraz is a federal and not a state facility?
That's the fascinating part about this case, Tim, because when you think about it, One of the attorneys kept saying, "Well, we there is proof," they said, "that this is indeed going to be a facility that's going to be funded by the feds eventually." So the relationship is there. They even use tweets by Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, talking about the facility. They used a lot of different approaches to try to persuade the judge that indeed there was a relationship between the state and the feds, and that the feds eventually will fund or reimburse the state for the
Right.
facility. Therefore, they argue that it is a federal there is a federal relationship there, right? That the federal government has a relationship with the state, and in a way is running the facility.
But what about that federal argument, though, that Alligator Alcatraz was in effect no different than any state or local detention facility, like, let's say, a county jail that holds migrant detainees for federal immigration authorities? I mean, they even went out of their way to say it's the Florida Department of Emergency Management that's running the facility, not the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, for example. And their argument was, well, we don't make county jails subject to the National Environmental Policy Act or other federal standards like that. So they said, why should Judge Williams? She found that argument unpersuasive. Hatzell, why do you think she found it unpersuasive?
You know, one of the interesting things about this judge is that she does not hold back. When you were in court listening to the hearings and to both sides make their arguments, one of the things that I found astounding is that she kept saying, "Well, listen, why did this facility have to be built there? Why that spot? Couldn't it have been built next to, for example, Chrome Detention Center?" Which I think it was argued in the hearings that there's enough space there to build the tents. I just, Tim, it was really interesting to see the back and forth and what she had to say, which you knew this kind of ruling was coming based on just what the reactions that she had and the questions that she had for the state and federal officials or the attorneys.
I think the state and the Trump administration saw it coming too. But that leads us into the question, Hatzell, how big a setback is this for the Trump administration and Governor DeSantis, particularly since DeSantis seemed to prize Alligator Alcatraz as a showcase of his efforts to be the most zealous state partner of President Trump's sweeping crusade to round up and deport every undocumented migrant in the United States? I mean, as I mentioned, DeSantis has already got a replacement Alligator Alcatraz-style detention center online up near Jacksonville, which he's already calling Deportation Depot. So in the end, is last night's ruling really a setback for them, Hatzell?
Tim, I think it is politically for the governor because, as you mentioned, ever since this facility opened, the governor does not shy away from touting this as a great partnership between the state and the federal government. In fact, he says other states should be doing the same thing. And as we have seen now, he has opened a second facility to show that this is a best practice, so to speak, when it comes to immigration enforcement and the relationship between the feds and the state. So yeah, I mean, it is a big setback because politically now he has to continue to fight by way of appeal.
And we do have Elise Bennett with us now from the Center for Biological Diversity, as I said, one of the plaintiffs in this suit that was ruled on last night. Elise, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for coming on.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Elise, I want to look at a public opinion facet of this Alligator Alcatraz ruling. Floridians do take Everglades protection seriously. And I think obviously that was one of the arguments that you and the other plaintiffs brought to this case. In fact, Everglades protection has been one of Governor DeSantis's calling cards as a politician. And yet, in his passion to create an immigration law and order showcase out in the Everglades, he might have lost sight of that. Either way, Alligator Alcatraz sits at an idle airstrip facility that decades ago was itself ruled an environmental hazard out there. So, Elise, remind us what groups like yours pointed to in this case as the most serious environmental threats Alligator Alcatraz poses to the Everglades.
Well, you're exactly right. Both the Trump and DeSantis administrations underestimated Floridians' love for and interest in protecting the Everglades, and I think that was their fatal mistake. And so when the time came where the trucks were rolling into the site, where we saw trucks filled with asphalt and fill material, fences, portalettes, trailers, diesel generators, stadium-style lighting, Most Floridians were horrified. We see the Everglades as part of our identity, and the idea of turning it into this circus in the middle of one of our most vulnerable ecosystems was too much for most to take.
But in the nitty-gritty details of it, things like human waste, etc. Did Judge Williams seem to accept the fact that this just was not compatible with Everglades preservation out there?
Precisely. So we brought experts into the courtroom to talk about, first of all, the addition of new pavement across the site, acres of new pavement, and just the pollutants that come off of that pavement alone, washing off into the surrounding wetlands. And for folks who aren't familiar with this area, the site of this one sole remaining runway is completely surrounded by water. You can see it in aerial videos. You can see the sun just shining off the water as planes pass over. And so anything that falls onto the asphalt or falls onto the ground on that site goes directly into the Everglades, flows downstream from Big Cypress to Everglades National Park and to the Miccosukee Reserved Area, where a large proportion of the Miccosukee tribe's community lives.
And I want to get to that later. But also the 24-hour lighting was a big consideration too, right? In terms of, the life's the clocks, the biological clocks of the life of the wildlife out there.
Absolutely. My organization is dedicated to protecting endangered species like the Florida panther and the Florida bonneted bat, both of which are nocturnal creatures. Florida bonneted bats hunt only at night. They're the second largest bat in the world, and they're Florida's largest bat, and they're only found here in our state. So they're really an icon of the unique biodiversity here. And we have scientific evidence that they won't hunt in lit areas. And so we've removed huge areas of hunting habitat for them.
No, that's
Same for the panthers.
an interesting detail. Hatzilvela, I also wanted to hear your sense of what the public reaction to this ruling is likely to be. A new YouGov poll out this week, for example, shows almost 60% of Americans now think President Trump's immigration policies are too harsh, and a majority said they disapprove of alligator Alcatraz. Should Trump and DeSantis perhaps conclude that they overreached on this one and just cut their losses?
I honestly don't think that's going to happen.
All
I mean, I think they're going to continue to take different routes to make their points, whether it's by way of an alligator, Alcatraz, or other means to think. Remember, the governor always keeps saying that there's a mandate for this, that the president was elected to do this, and I think that's that they truly believe that, and that's truly what we're seeing here. But when you talk about public reaction, let me tell you. When all the attorneys I've talked to, inmates I've talked to, I mean, everybody is praising what the judge has done here just because of the multitude of not just complaints, but and you're going to get this, but the constitutional concerns in terms of rights for the folks in there.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Elise Bennett of the Center for Biological Diversity and Hatzilvela of NBC6 about last night's federal court order to effectively shut down alligator Alcatraz. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Elise Bennett, I want to get to what we just mentioned briefly there earlier, that along with environmental organizations like yours, the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians, which considers the Everglades its home, was also a plaintiff in the suit that Judge Williams ruled on last night. And we should note that as a result, a big part of the argument made in the case wasn't just about environmental damage, but about infringement on sacred tribal land. How important did that end up being in the judge's injunction, do you think?
Very important. The Miccosukee tribe has safeguarded these lands for time immemorial, and their witnesses came to the stand to talk about the very real access concerns. So there are many areas of the actual jet port site that the Miccosukee tribe used to access trails for hunting and accessing Big Cypress. Also water quality and impact to species that they have worked so hard to protect in the Everglades.
Hatzilvela, I want to touch on another alligator Alcatraz ruling this week from another federal judge in Miami. It involved a suit led by the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, which claimed that the detention facility is violating detainees' constitutional rights, such as in-person and confidential access to attorneys. The judge, Rodolfo Ruiz, said that case had to be moved to the federal court district in Collier County, which he said is where Alligator Alcatraz is technically located, not Miami-Dade. But he did not dismiss that constitutional argument the suit makes. How important should we consider that case last night's?
Yeah, it is a very important case because really, aside from the environmental concerns, that's really been the gist of Alligator Alcatraz since it opened, the concerns about detainees not having access to their attorneys, the concern by attorneys who have told me, I don't feel like I have that attorney-client privilege when I'm inside the facility meeting with their clients, when they finally were able to go inside and start meeting with their clients. And then the second thing, which really is important, is the ability for clients to see an immigration judge. Up until this point, about 2 weeks ago, I would say, that was not a possibility. In fact, I talked and interviewed an attorney who said her immigration bond hearing was canceled last minute because the judge, the immigration judge in this case, felt he did not have jurisdiction over detainees at Alligator Alcatraz. Right. Now, we should emphasize, though, that that has now changed, and there was an act by the federal government where they said, no, we have set up a way for detainees at Alligator Alcatraz to have access to judges at Chrome. Mm-hmm. So that, because that changed, the judge found that it was a moot point, but still it was addressed in the court. Yeah. And for the ACLU, they saw that as a win.
Oh, no, they definitely saw it as a victory.
Yeah.
Because now it'll just be transferred over to the federal district over in Collier County and not in Miami. But still, Hatzel, we hear the Trump administration at the same time will appeal Judge Williams' order to halt operations at Alligator Alcatraz within 60 days and bring no more additional detainees there. Here's what Governor DeSantis had to say about that this morning.
This is a judge that was not going to give us a fair shake. This is not going to deter us. Continue working on the deportations, advancing that mission. We knew that this would be something that would likely happen, and we will respond accordingly. This mission is important. You either have a country or you don't.
So, Hatzel, do you think they stand a better chance in a federal appellate court? I mean, we have in recent weeks seen lower court rulings blocking President Trump's immigration agenda overruled by appellate courts. Do you think the White House believes that that's likely in this case?
I think they're going to, as I mentioned before, I think they're going to continue to fight. They're going to see how far they can go, whether it's the appellate courts or ultimately the Supreme Court, I think, right? Remember, let's go back to the argument about the mandate and them believing that this is truly what they should be doing. So you're going to see this legal fight continue beyond this district, or the Southern District Court in Florida.
We have Michael on the line from Coconut Grove. Michael, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts on all this?
Hey, you know, I just wanted to interject something and have your guest comment on the angle of that. Aren't there private subcontractors? And I feel like a lot of this detention stuff is based on a for-profit motive with these companies. And I know this is a little bit different with the tents being set up, but is there a big money factor here of people making a lot of money privately?
Elise Bennett, what's your assessment of that question that Michael brings up?
You know, that's not a critical aspect of our case, but it hasn't gone unnoticed that millions of dollars have gone into building this tent compound, and much of that has gone to private contractors. And I think I've been grateful for the investigative reporting that's gone into highlighting those expenditures and who's receiving them.
Right. And Elise, let me just end with you then here. The same question that I was asking Hatzel, but from a plaintiff's perspective, do you think President Trump and Governor DeSantis might have a better chance in the federal appellate courts? Meaning, essentially, what do you think the higher courts might be more sympathetic to from the government than perhaps Judge Williams was last night?
I think we expected that they would appeal and that they will seek a stay at every level they possibly can. But I will say this, Judge William entered a very thoughtful and comprehensive order, 82 pages, based on her own factual findings and her determinations of credibility of the witnesses. And it's worth pointing out that we brought many witnesses and hundreds of records for the judge to review. The other side, both federal and state defendants, brought one witness and couldn't present the meaningful purpose behind putting a tent compound in the middle of the Everglades. And so we feel quite confident that, you know, we can move forward and that we can maintain this preliminary injunction until we can get permanent relief.
Elise Bennett is Florida and Caribbean Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Hatzel Vela is a politics reporter for NBC6. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Still to come, Florida removes rainbow crosswalks. Is it public policy or public bigotry? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. A couple nights ago, the Florida Department of Transportation sent workers into Orlando to remove a rainbow-colored crosswalk on Esther Street outside the Pulse nightclub. The crosswalk was put there 8 years ago to memorialize the 49 mostly LGBTQ people who were targeted and murdered at the Pulse by a gunman in 2016. But Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' administration says the rainbow crosswalk violated a new state law banning, quote, political banners from public roadways. It was just the latest such crosswalk being targeted around Florida, and especially in South Florida, where cities like Delray Beach, Key West, and Miami Beach are also in the crosshairs of a law that critics say isn't about public safety, but about right-wing efforts to stamp out tributes to LGBTQ and other minority communities. Either way, it's also raising the stakes in Governor Ron DeSantis' seeming crusade to eradicate local home rule in Florida, something that used to be a Republican hallmark. Joining me now to discuss this are Miami Beach Commissioner Laura Dominguez and Delray Beach Commissioner Rob Long. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
We'd like to hear your thoughts on this dispute, as long as those thoughts are respectful and not hateful, no matter which side of this discussion you're on. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Laura Dominguez, let me just start with a statement that we received when we reached out to the Florida Department of Transportation last night. They told us its duty is, quote, to ensure the safety and consistency of public roadways. That means ensuring they're not utilized for social, political, or ideological interests, including pavement markings on state and local roads. According to that, end quote. According to that FDOT criteria, Laura, your city, Miami Beach, and a host of others in Florida are in violation. Why then are you defying the order? What are you communicating to the FDOT in that regard?
Well, I'm an ally for the LGBTQ community. I'm fully committed to preserving the crosswalk. The city installed the rainbow crosswalk about 8 years ago, and it's been part of that intersection on 12th and Ocean Drive since then without incident. We even installed it in coordination with the county. Even though the city owns Ocean Drive, the county has regional transportation regulatory authority to review the traffic control measures. And for 8 years, we've had it there, and it's very important to our city.
Rob Long, same question to you in Delray Beach regarding your own LGBTQ pride crosswalk there. Why are you remaining defiant in the face of losing state funding and other threats? And just as important, why do you think you have the legal, if not constitutional, grounding to be defiant in this situation? What are you telling the state right now?
Great question. I think it's important to note that in Delray Beach, and I think many other cities, these are city-owned streets. We own and maintain these streets. So to me, this is not only just about representation, it's a home rule issue.
Right, and I want to get to that a little later.
Yeah. Exactly. And there's another part to this, which is that the federal MUTCD, which is the federal standard for roadway markings, does allow for asphalt painting.
Right.
And so the FDOT, who has not passed, there have been no new bills, no new laws that have changed the scope of what these issues are. However, it just seems to be a reinterpretation by FDOT.
Right.
now, to now start being to enforce this in a different way than they ever have before. So right. I don't know that they have any legal standing.
Now, the Florida Transportation Department says it's consulting local governments before it makes moves like the one Wednesday night to paint over Orlando's crosswalk memorial to the Pulse nightclub massacre victims. Orlando officials, however, insist they were not consulted. I want to play remarks from two of those officials. First, Democratic State Senator Carlos Smith of Orange County.
Of course they did this in the middle of the night because they knew what they were doing was wrong.
And then here is Democratic Orlando Commissioner Patty Sheehan, who is the first openly gay elected official in Central Florida.
This is not the America I grew up in. This is wrong. This is simply erasing people. It's making political statements, and it shouldn't be happening in the United States of America. It certainly shouldn't be happening in the state of Florida. We followed all the rules. We did it right, and we should not be punished for it.
So, Laura Dominguez, I want to focus there on two points Patty Sheehan makes. First, that the DeSantis government is trying to erase a certain community's identity. And second, that it's just trying to make political statements, not public policy. I guess I'd point out that conservatives like Governor DeSantis make a similar argument. For example, every time we try to put up the Ten Commandments in a public place, you secular liberals try to erase our identity, and that by removing your pride crosswalks, we're simply blocking you from making political statements on public property. Do they have a point, or what to your mind is wrong with their thinking in that regard?
Well, for Miami Beach, from 1st to 87th Street, the LGBT community has been longstanding. We have a lot of respect for the community, and the crosswalks represent something visible, vibrant for them. And it extends even onto the beach with our lifeguard stand, which is also rainbow colored. So for them, it's personal. But we have representation of other groups in different areas of our city. This just happens to focus in on the LGBTQ community, and it's very important to us.
Rob Long, let me put the same question to you. What to your mind is the flaw in the thinking of Governor DeSantis and the Republicans that's behind the prohibition of public displays of tribute to communities like the LGBTQ, especially when they make that comparison of liberals objecting to, say, a nativity creche on public property at Christmas?
It's a great question. So the true irony here is, we're not making a political statement. It's a statement of unity and acceptance that we have in our own community, not bothering anyone. We're down here minding our own business, and all of a sudden Tallahassee is sending a directive and saying that this thing that they don't like is now political. They have made it into the political issue as far as I'm concerned. And if we're comparing that to the Ten Commandments or nativity scene at a public school, that goes back to the separation of church and state. That the state cannot sponsor one religion over the others. That's the issue, right? Mm-hmm. They can put that in all the private schools they want. But when you sponsor the Christian religion, for instance, over all the other religions that students going to that school may subscribe to, that goes against their constitution. That's what that is.
Okay.
So it's not about silencing their views. It's mm-hmm. about following the rule of law.
Okay. We have Maggie from Okeechobee on the line. Maggie, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts on this?
My thought is that there's a big irony here. I got notified yesterday about a request to buy a specific license plate to be used, obviously, on Florida roadways by the Florida. It's actually to support Israel. And the person selling the idea says you want to buy one of these, you know, custom plates from the Department of Motor Vehicles to show your support for Israel as they're going through such a tough time with their conflict. Personally, I was offended by the call. Mm-hmm. I have lots of Jewish friends. I'm even a Republican. But the idea that somebody would call when I actually have the opposite point of view and try to push license plates that mm-hmm. support an extremely politically diverse, as they said, they're trying to, argument that they started the conversation with was it's not supposed to be political mm-hmm. on our road.
So you see a double standard there, Maggie. No, thanks very much for your call. It's a good point. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami Beach Commissioner Laura Dominguez and Delray Beach Commissioner Rob Long about Florida's efforts under a new state law to remove gay pride crosswalks and other public tributes to minorities. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Laura Dominguez, I want to pivot to the big governmental question here, which we sort of brought up earlier, but cities like Miami Beach are arguing that LGBTQ pride rainbow crosswalks like the one Florida removed in Orlando this week are locally approved public expressions and that the state is violating home rule, or rather that it's an unconstitutional preemption of local home rule, something Governor DeSantis and the Republican-controlled legislature have become quite famous for in this decade. But do local governments in Florida really have the state constitutional right to make that argument? And is that how Miami Beach plans to fight this in the end?
So it's currently being reviewed by our legal team at City Hall. We did receive the letter this week. The city has 14 days to respond, which gives us until September the 4th. I mentioned earlier that Ocean Drive is a local road, so it's not a state road. And our next commission meeting is September 3rd. So I am sure we will be having a robust discussion at that meeting on how to fight this.
But I should point out, as I read that FDOT statement earlier, they include local roads in their interpretation of these state guidelines. So Rob Long, can you weigh in on that same question, please? Do local governments in Florida really have the right to claim home rule as a legal guard against the state's efforts to decide what you can and can't do with your crosswalks or anything else for that matter? And again, will that be the basis for Delray Beach's fight in this regard?
Yeah, I think there are multiple different things that give us some legal footing in the fight going forward. Home rule is one of them, but as I referenced earlier, there is a conflict between the federal standard and what FDOT is currently doing. So I think there are multiple different avenues that our legal team could take in this administrative hearing that's going to come up. And we still are reviewing other options, especially in light of what happened in Orlando. Mm-hmm. We do not want to risk FDOT or someone coming in destroying our crosswalk while we're still going through a legal process to resolve this issue. Right. And that is a fear right now. And I've recommended to our city manager that we have police surveillance right now to overlook our Pride streetscape during this time. Mm-hmm.
Could that also, when you talk about federal standards, for example, could that also include maybe even civil rights standards? Because we are talking about, you know, a minority community and expressions of that community.
Absolutely. This definitely goes into a freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And that may be one of the legal avenues that we employ at this point.
Laura Dominguez, that brings me to something. I also want to step back and look at a larger picture here in the sense that Governor DeSantis's critics say this follows a rather homophobic pattern that we've seen in so-called anti-woke measures like Florida's Don't Say Gay law that seem bent on erasing public acknowledgement of the LGBTQ community. In an LGBTQ welcome city like Miami Beach, how big is that fear?
So we are very, very mindful that this is something that is not right. It's an attack on the LGBTQ community, and we do want to fight it. I remember back when the Don't Say Gay bill came out, I was a resident then, and the city, in conjunction with some advocacy groups like Save and Equality Florida, conducted a rally, and the attendance, the love, the vibrancy that was at that rally. So as we are embarking and navigating how best to fight this crosswalk measure, I know that the community will be behind us supporting what the city's planning.
Rob Long, as I mentioned at the outset, Key West and other Florida cities are also targets of the state's ban on pride crosswalks and other public LGBTQ recognition. But what do residents in Delray Beach have to say in that regard? Do they also see more homophobia than public safety involved here in the state's actions?
Absolutely. And what I'll say is the fact that this happened in Orlando kind of shows what the title of Adam Serwer's book, Cruelty is the Point, right? So to attack the symbol in Orlando, which is literally to bring attention to and memorialize a hate crime, a mass murder. And to begin there, and arguably the most poignant symbol of what it means to be represented in Florida. So to me, to start there, that shows this is political. That proves it. That throws any argument about safety out the window. And in Delray Beach, mm-hmm. in our meeting this week, we had the highest attendance I have ever seen in a Delray Beach meeting. In all of it, every single person who spoke about this issue was in support of fighting for home rule and fighting for representation of the LGBTQ plus community.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for time. Rob Long is a commissioner in Delray Beach. Laura Dominguez is a commissioner in Miami Beach. Many thanks to you both. Still to come, should President Trump send U.S. troops to fight Latin America's drug wars? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Since taking office again in January, President Trump has threatened to annex Greenland, make Canada the 51st state, and take back the Panama Canal. But recently he's been rattling hemispheric sabers of a more serious sort. He's made suggestions about sending the U.S. military into Mexico to fight that country's powerful and violent drug cartels, which send so much fentanyl into our communities here, and perhaps even into Venezuela, a country whose own military is the major drug cartel. Problem is, history tends to warn us that turning soldiers into drug interdiction agents doesn't always end very well. Police and prosecutors and judges are trained to bring down organized crime. Militaries are trained to fight other militaries, and their brute force risks making narco-violence worse in many cases. Then again, when Latin America's police and judicial systems are so ineffective and corrupt, should sending in our Marines be an option? Joining me now to examine that question is Brian Fonseca. He's director of the Gordon Institute for Public Policy at Florida International University and an expert on military and security affairs in the Americas. Brian, thanks for talking with us, as always.
No, thanks, Tim, for having me on.
What's your opinion of President Trump's possible plan to send the U.S. military into Latin America's narco wars? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Brian, in the interest of full disclosure here, I wrote a column this week for WLRN.org in which I argued it's a mistake to use the military to confront drug cartels. I wrote that soldiers do not make good drug cops. And I based a lot of my claim on what I, as a correspondent, personally watched happen in Mexico a couple decades ago. But I know a lot of people will disagree with my argument, so let me just start by asking your expert assessment here. What are the pros and cons of employing the military instead of police in the fight against drug cartels?
Well, first, Tim, let me say that you argued your position incredibly well. It was a really thoughtful piece, and I think you have some really good perspectives in terms of the challenges that we've faced in terms of leveraging military institutions to disrupt criminal enterprises. And so I think there are certainly challenges in part of deploying of U.S. military assets and force is the challenge of, you know, breaching, you know, sovereignty of other nations in which sort of house,
sure,
you know, the you know, criminal enterprises, and then, of course, undermining, you know, sort of the you know, criminal and sort of administration of justice, the processes that are in place in countries that, to your point, as you said at the outset, have not been incredibly affected. Mm-hmm. Here's the challenge I think that we're up against, that in many cases, particularly the cartels that the U.S. has been labeling, you know, sort of as terrorist organizations, right? I think that's an important element to this piece, is that
right,
the Trump administration. Go ahead.
No, I agree. That's a very good point, and I'm glad you brought it up, that the administration has labeled these cartels as terrorist organizations now, and that puts that in a whole different dynamic.
Right, and the purpose of that is to be able to unlock the military as an instrument
of
sort of national power to target these organizations, and it's largely because the blurring of lines in terms of the breadth and reach that these organizations have. Certainly, terrorist organizations have diversified their portfolios. You know, they're moving opium around the world. They've moved into the criminal enterprise business, you know, and that's thanks largely in part to successes from the United States in terms of targeting financial, you know, sort of financial means that terrorist organizations leverage to operate.
Right.
And I think, again, consistent with what we're seeing with cartels, these are robust criminal networks that in many ways outgun local law enforcement agencies. They're transnational in nature, and so they move across borders in far more seamless ways. And in many ways, there are sort of connective tissue between those criminal organizations and co-optation or corruption of nation. And in some cases, like the Venezuela case, in which you have criminal organizations that are deeply embedded within the institutions of governance, particularly the military, that you can't dislodge with local law enforcement or sort of processes of justice, even at the international realm. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, part of this is leveraging a handful of, and it's not sort of broad across the board, all, drug cartels are now terrorist organizations, and thus we can use the military. It is, here are the ones that have the sort of robust infrastructure that we think the military is best suited to leverage in order to get after these cartels.
And then let's pivot to President Trump's increasingly vocal desire to deploy U.S. military assets to the fight against Mexico's drug cartel, something that conservative politicians in the U.S. have been suggesting for decades, actually, as you and I know. What exactly, though, do you think Trump has in mind, Brian? Does he really mean a bona fide U.S. military invasion of, say, Mexican cartel strongholds like Sinaloa? Or is he thinking more of enhanced cooperation between the Mexican and U.S. militaries in this fight? Either way, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum isn't too thrilled with the idea, right?
Yeah, and I think it's the latter. I think it's, on one end, applying pressure to both the Mexican government and the cartels that the U.S. military is now on the table, right, in terms of an asset that the U.S. can deploy in order to disrupt drug flows into the United States. I think that's important. So there is a pressure element to it. And I think it's also in an effort to, extend or incentivize deeper U.S.-Mexico cooperation where the military can be used as an asset to help the Mexican government go after criminal enterprises that are deeply entrenched within sort of Mexico's geography, but also within and across the Mexico sort of political public institutions, right? And that includes law enforcement.
Let's stick with Mexico here then, Brian. I go back to the point I tried to make in my column this week that Mexico seems to be a cautionary tale about using soldiers to fight narco mafias. Critics say Mexico showed that the blunt, shock and awe nature of military force simply exacerbated the situation there, especially the narco-related violence. How do you look at the Mexican experience in terms of this debate, looking back a couple decades ago?
Well, and you pointed out in your column that ultimately you see an increase in violence, and I think that's true, right? Anytime you're going to leverage the military as an instrument of force, it's likely going to provoke violence because, as you point out, the militaries are trained to fight, fight wars, not sort of, detain and process through civilian, justice systems to determine guilt. It's designed to go in as a blunt instrument and achieve a particular political or military outcome. And so I think the Mexico case, and you pointed out earlier Venezuela, the Venezuelan case are very different, right?
Yeah.
In the case of Venezuela, you may be talking about sort of a state that is co-opted or deeply ingrained with criminal enterprises, akin to what, and I say this cautiously, but the Panama experience back in 1989 was sort of labeling Panama as a narco state and the U.S. military going in and displacing Noriega.
Right.
I think Mexico is a very different case. It is a case of capacity and governance.
Right.
And so I think your cautionary tale in the Mexico context is very important because sending military into, urban centers with weapons drawn to disrupt criminal organizations could lead to broader violence, particularly as those organizations fight back, which is why we saw such a rise in violence during the Calderon period, where the Mexican government did try to take the cartels on and displace them.
Calderon being the president, Calderon of Mexico in that period. But so let's then turn across the Caribbean then, Brian, to President Trump reportedly sending U.S. warships with thousands of Marines on board, all aimed at some sort of counter-narcotics operation focused on Venezuela, where we know the socialist dictator there, Nicolas Maduro, has been indicted in the U.S., along with several top Venezuelan military leaders, for drug trafficking. Again, Brian, what is the reality in terms of what President Trump wants to do there and what he can do there?
Right. And let me add one other element to it, a recent increase in the bounty on Maduro to $50
million.
So what's important here is this is pressure, right? This is pressure. And by the way, Maduro responded by mobilizing a million militia. And so there's a dynamic right now between the United States and Venezuela where we're communicating through these sort of gestures of, you know, increased militarization of the tensions. I think that what the White House is trying to do, first, and I suspect, and Tim, you know this, militaries have plans for all contingencies, right?
Right.
If there is a contingency to go in, there's a plan on the shelf. If there's a contingency to interdict, you know, international waters, there's a plan on the shelf. And so the military as an instrument is on the table across the board for wherever the White House policy is sort of moving us in that case. But
okay.
I think the warships are really there, like the U.S. Navy and sort of military presence in the Caribbean to combat drug trafficking, bringing those assets in, and the thousands of Marines that are on that ship mm-hmm. is also part of a pressure campaign on Venezuela, you know, to help disrupt Venezuela's role and sort of tighten, you know, the control around dislodging criminal actors that may be
right.
operating in Venezuela's territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bounty, the ships, this is all an application of pressure. On Venezuela.
Right.
And it's not just drugs. It's other things, too. Migration.
Sure.
Energy. I mean, there's a broader policy towards Venezuela that's unfolding mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. context.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with FIU's Brian Fonseca about the possibility of President Trump sending our military to fight Latin American drug cartels and whether that's a good or bad idea. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Brian, speaking of Venezuela, Republican Florida Congresswoman Ashley Moody, who this week was in the large Venezuelan exile enclave of Doral here, and this is what she had to say in support of what President Trump is doing with those warships.
The administration announced that they will be surging military assets into the international waters around Venezuela to go after the root cause of much of the narco trade and Maduro, who is the head of a narco organization. That is action. That is someone that hears the calls of Americans that says, pay attention to what is killing Americans. Do not be distracted. And President Trump heard that.
Brian, the implicit argument there is that drugs like fentanyl, for example, have wrought so much death and pain in American communities in recent years that it's become necessary now to resort to our military to fight it. What do you think of that claim?
Yeah, I mean, again, it harkens back to the 80s, right? Paradise Lost and sort of the surge in engaging the military in combating illicit trafficking outside of America's borders. And I mean, the fentanyl issue in and of itself is not exclusive to Venezuela. You know, there have been implications of sort of Chinese product movements into Mexico
right.
that have contributed to the fentanyl, mm-hmm. you know, skyrocketing in the United States. And then sort of the pivot around, you know, not just distribution of pills, you know, sort of now pill production happening on the American side of the border. And
mm-hmm.
so this is a much bigger issue that, you know, Venezuela may be a small cog in the context specifically around fentanyl.
Yeah.
You know, that said, again, I think this is part of a larger or broader, you know, U.S. objective to put mm-hmm. pressure on Venezuela, not just in the context of,
right.
you know, his equities and illicit trafficking flows, but also
mm-hmm.
the issue around dictatorship and sort of the repression of political
mm-hmm.
opposition,
yeah.
the flows of migration, the issues around energy, the
mm-hmm.
displacing of China and Russia that may be operating, you know, more liberally in Venezuela. I think there's a broader equity that the White House is looking for in response, you know, in result of putting pressure on Venezuela. And I think this is another element of that pressure by parking those ships off. And then, you know, pairing that with the bounty.
Yeah.
Remember, the military in Venezuela, I've always argued, is the key
right.
to continuity or change.
Brian, unfortunately, we have to leave it there for time. This has been fascinating, though. Brian Fonseca is director of the Gordon Institute for Public Policy at Florida International University. Brian, thanks as always. We really appreciate it. Finally, on the roundup, arts and culture funding in Miami-Dade County is no longer entirely on the chopping block. For now, Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava has announced this week that her administration found $66 million additional budget dollars to fight funding, to continue funding community grants. She's warned it's just a temporary fix, though. But at least that's better than news than we got from her previous budget proposal, which got rid of the country's Department of Cultural Affairs and many grants for local arts programs in an effort to close a $402 million budget deficit. The reprieve comes after local art leaders voiced loud concerns. Here's what Beth Boone, director of the nonprofit Miami Light Project, told WLRN's Jimena Romero.
There are 32,000 workers in the sector, and there is a $2.1 billion impact on the city. Miami, being a great city, is precisely because of the art and culture sector.
County commissioners are scheduled to discuss the proposed budget next Thursday. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. This show was produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.